That's the Young Men from Memphis with Blue and Boogie. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, August the 30th. And the British Parliament yesterday rejected a motion by Prime Minister David Cameron to join an allied military strike against Syria's Bashar al-Assad for allegedly using chemical weapons in rebel strongholds that have killed hundreds of civilians and injured thousands more in the ongoing civil war that has gripped the country since April last year. What is instructive is the process that produced the vote yesterday, a vigorous, freewheeling, open debate with the Prime Minister alternatively making his case and being called to account, with an equally vigorous challenge from opposition leaders and splinter parties. President Obama and his administration and Congress, on the other hand, are contemplating possible U.S. involvement and have already mobilized the military. But all of this has been done behind closed doors, shutting out the public, shutting out scrutiny of the process, dare I say the word, transparency. Shutting out transparency. We are going to take a look at the differences in how the same issue is being dealt with. We've heard nothing from the administration. We've heard no great explanation from the administration, nothing major from Congress, and yet this country is poised on the brink of war in Syria. So I thought it would be important to let you appreciate how this vote went yesterday in the British Parliament. It was an all-day event, very strong discussion, and very instructive about this term, democracy. Let's take a listen. You will hear, as we start out, Prime Minister David Cameron making his case. You will hear later on when the opposition leader, Ed Miliband, begins to present the other side of the issue.
The question before the House today is how to respond to one of the most abhorrent uses of chemical weapons in a century, slaughtering innocent men, women and children in Syria. It is not about taking sides in the Syrian conflict. It is not about invading. It is not about regime change or even working more closely with the opposition. It is about the large-scale use of chemical weapons and our response to a war crime, nothing else. Yeah. In reaching our conclusions, let me set out what the House has in front of it today. We have a summary of the government's legal position, making explicit that military action would have a clear legal basis in a moment. We have the key independent judgments of the Joint Intelligence Committee, making clear their view of what happened and who is responsible. And we have a motion from the government that sets out a very careful path of steps that need to be taken before Britain could participate. And we have a motion from the government that sets out a very careful path of steps that need to be taken before Britain could participate in any direct military action. These include the weapons inspector's reporting, further action at the United Nations, and another vote in this House of Commons. And the motion also makes clear that even if all these steps are taken, anything we do would have to be legal, proportionate, and specifically focused on deterring and preventing further use of chemical weapons. Let me give way to the Honourable Lady.
I'm very grateful to the Prime Minister for giving way, but could he tell the House why he has refused to publish the full Attorney-General advice? Why has he instead just published a one-and-a-half-side summary of it, especially at a time when so many legal experts are saying that without explicit UN Security Council reinforcement, this simply is not legal under international law?
Yeah. Well, there's been a long-standing convention backed by Attorney-Generals of all parties and of all governments not to publish any legal advice at all. Now, this government has changed that, and with the Libya conflict, which we published a summary of the legal advice, and with this issue, we have published a very clear summary of the legal advice, and I would urge all honourable and right honourable members to read it. Now, Mr. Speaker, I am, of course, deeply mindful of the lessons of previous conflicts. I'm going to make some progress, and then I will take a huge number of interventions. I am deeply mindful of the lessons of previous conflicts, and in particular, the deep concerns in the country caused by what went wrong with the Iraq conflict in 2003. But this is not like Iraq. What we are seeing in Syria is fundamentally different. We are not invading a country. We're not searching for chemical or biological weapons. The case for ultimately, and I say ultimately because there'd have to be another vote in this House, the case for ultimately supporting action is not based on a specific piece or pieces of intelligence. The fact the Syrian government has and has used chemical weapons is beyond doubt. The fact that the most recent attack took place is not seriously doubted. The Syrian government has said it took place. Even the Iranian president said that it took place. And the evidence that the Syrian regime has used these weapons in the early hours of the 21st of August is right in front of our eyes. We have multiple eyewitness accounts of chemical-filled rockets being used against opposition-controlled areas. We have thousands of social media reports and at least 95 different videos, horrific videos, documenting the evidence. But the differences with 2003 and the situation with Iraq go wider. Then Europe was divided over what should be done. Now Europe is united in the view that we should not let this chemical weapons use stand. Then NATO was divided. Today NATO has made a very clear statement that those who are responsible should be held accountable. Back in 2003, the Arab League was opposed to action. Now they are calling for it. They've issued a statement holding the Syrian regime fully responsible and asking the international community to overcome internal disagreements and to take action against those who committed this crime. I give way to my right honourable friend.
I'm grateful to my right honourable friend. As he knows, a couple of days ago, I was expecting to oppose the government tonight. But is my right honourable friend aware that his determination to go down the route of the United Nations and his willingness to hold a further vote in this House will be extremely helpful in making up my mind tonight?
Well, I'm grateful to my right honourable friend. In drawing up my motion, I want to unite as much of the country and as much of this House as possible. I think it is right on these vital issues of national and international importance to seek the greatest possible consensus. I think that is the right thing for the government to do, and we will continue to do that. Let me make some more progress. Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, is a man who opposed the action in Iraq. No one could in any way describe him as a president who wants to involve America in more wars in the Middle East. But he profoundly believes that an important red line has been crossed in an appalling way, and that is why he supports action in this case. When I spoke to President Obama last weekend, I said we shared his view about the despicable nature of this use of chemical weapons and that we must not stand aside. But I also explained, let me make this point, I also explained to him that because of the damage done to public confidence by Iraq, we would have to follow a series of incremental steps, including at the United Nations, to build public confidence and ensure the maximum possible legitimacy for any action. These steps are all set out in the motion before the House today. And let me say, Mr. Speaker, I remember in 2003, I was sitting there two rows from the back on the opposition benches. It was just after my son had been born, and he was not well, but I was determined to be here. I wanted to listen to the man standing right here and believe everything that he told me. We're not here to debate those issues today, but one thing is indisputable. The well of public opinion was well and truly poisoned by the Iraq episode, and we need to understand the public scepticism. I give way to the right honourable lady.
I'm most grateful to the Prime Minister for giving way. My reading of his motion
tells me that everything within it could have been debated on Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
This House has been recalled, and I believe it was recalled in order to give cover for possible military action this weekend.
Yes.
Has the Prime Minister made it clear to President Obama that in no way does this country support any attack that could come before the UN inspectors have done their job?
I recall, wanted the recall of this House to debate these absolutely vital national and international issues. But I will answer her question very directly. It is this House that will decide what steps we next take. If you agree to the motion I've set down, no action can be taken until we have heard from the UN weapons inspectors, until there's been further action at the United Nations and another vote in this House. Those are the conditions that we, the British government, the British Parliament are setting, and I think it's absolutely right that we do so. Let me make a little bit more progress and then I will take interventions from across the House. Now, this deep public cynicism imposes particular responsibilities on me as Prime Minister to try and carry people in the country and people in this House with me. I feel that very deeply. That is why I wanted Parliament recalled, and I want this debate to bring the country together and not divide it. That is why I've included in my motion, in the government motion, all the issues that I could that were raised with me by the Leader of the Opposition and indeed by many colleagues on all sides of the House, in the Liberal Democrat Party and the Conservative Party on other sides of the House, because I want us to try to have the greatest possible unity on this issue. Now, I have read the opposition motion carefully and it has much to commend it. The need for the UN investigators to report, quite right. The importance of the process at the United Nations, quite right. And the commitment to another vote in this House before any British participation in direct action. That is in our motion too. But I believe the opposition motion, this is important, let me make this point, is deficient in two vital respects. First, it refers to the deaths on the 21st of August, but does not in any way refer to the fact that they were caused by chemical weapons. Now, this fact is accepted by almost everyone across the world, and I think for the House to ignore it would send a very bad message to the world. Second, I'll just make this point, then I'll give it. Second, in no way does the opposition motion even begin to point the finger of blame at President Assad. Now, that is at odds with what has been said by NATO, President Obama, and every European and regional leader I've spoken to, by the governments of Australia, Canada, Turkey, and India, to name but few, and by the whole of the Arab League. It's at odds with the judgment of the Independent Joint Intelligence Committee, and I think the opposition amendment would be the wrong message for this House to send to the world, and for that reason I'll be recommending that my honourable friends vote against it. I give way to my honourable friend.
Mr. Speaker, I'm most grateful to my right honourable friend for giving way. In welcoming his decision to go through the UN process, could he confirm to the House that were we to find during that process overwhelming opposition in the General Assembly and a majority against it in the Security Council, as occurred 10 years ago, we wouldn't then just motor on?
No, I think it would be unthinkable to proceed if there was overwhelming opposition in the Security Council. Let me set out for the House why I think this issue is so important. Look, the very best route to follow is to have a Chapter 7 resolution, take it to the UN Security Council, have it passed, and then think about taking action. That is the path we followed with Libya. Now, this is a very... I want to make this point because I think this is very important. It cannot be the case that that is the only way to have a legal basis for action. And we should consider for a moment what the consequences would be if that were the case. You could have a situation in a country where its government was literally annihilating half the people in that country, but because of one veto on the Security Council, you would be hampered from taking any action. Now, I can't think of any member in any party of this House who'd want to sign up to that, and that's why it's important. We do have the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, which is set out in the Attorney General's excellent legal advice to this House. Let me give way to my honourable friend from Shrewsbury.
I'm very grateful to my right honourable friend, and I'm extremely grateful to him for taking the time to listen to the concerns of various residents in Shrewsbury about yet further British military intervention in the Middle East. However, can I ask him, why is it that our allies in the Middle East, like Saudi, Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait and others, cannot take military action? Why does it fall on us yet again?
My honourable friend makes a good point, and let's be clear, no decision about military action has been taken. It would require another vote of this House. But if we wanted to see action that was purely about deterring and degrading future chemical weapons use by Syria, and that is the only basis on which I would support any action, then you need countries that have the capabilities to do that, of which the United States and the United Kingdom are two, and there are very few other countries that will do that. I'll take one from my honourable friend here, and then one from the honourable, right honourable gentleman there.
On the matter of international law, did not the world leaders and the UN in 2005 sign up unanimously to the doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which means that if countries default in their responsibility to defend their own citizens, that the international community has a responsibility as a whole to defend those citizens. Syria has defaulted on its responsibility to protect its own citizens. Surely now the international community and ourselves do have a responsibility to undertake what we agreed to do just as recently as 2005.
My right honourable makes a very important point, and it relates to what happened in Kosovo and elsewhere, but let me be clear about what we're talking about today. Yes, it is that doctrine, but it's also about chemical weapons. It's about a treaty the whole world agreed to almost 100 years ago after the horrors of the First World War. And the question before us is Britain a country that wants to uphold that international taboo against the use of chemical weapons? And my argument is, yes, it should be that sort of country. Right honourable gentleman.
He cites the issues of Iraq and the impact they have on the decisions of today. But the perception, the justifiable perception, in my opinion, of his own preparedness to get involved in this conflict long before the current incident, surely has an impact on the decisions of today.
What I would say to the right honourable gentleman is the case I'm making is that the House of Commons needs to consider purely and simply this issue of a massive chemical weapons use by this regime. I'm not arguing we should get more involved in this conflict. I'm not arguing we should arm the rebels. I'm not making any of those arguments. The question before us as a government, as a House of Commons, as a world, is there is this 1925 agreement, post the First World War, these weapons are morally reprehensible, and do we want to try to maintain that law? Put simply, is it in Britain's national interest to maintain an international taboo about the use of chemical weapons on the battlefield? My argument is, yes, it is. Britain was part of drawing up that vital protocol, a protocol which, incidentally, Syria itself signed, and I think we have an interest in maintaining it. Let me take an intervention from the Democratic Unionist Party.
Thank the Prime Minister for giving way, and I don't know if there are many people in this House who do not believe that this debate today is a prelude to a decision which will eventually see us involved in Syria, but could he explain to us that if, as the briefing says today, there have already been 14 instances of use of chemical weapons, 100,000 people dead, 1.2 million people displaced, why is it only now that the Prime Minister thinks this is the time for greater intervention?
I think the point for considering this tougher approach is that we know there are the 14 uses of chemical weapons on a smaller scale, at least 14, and now we have this much larger use. And this does seem to me, and to President Obama, and to President Hollande, and to many others, an appropriate moment to ask whether it is time to do something to stand up for the prohibition against the use of chemical weapons. You can't, on the one hand, accuse me of rushing into something, but on the other hand, say, why have you waited for 14 chemical weapons attacks before you do something? Let me make a little bit of progress. In my speech, I want to do three things. I want to explain what we know, I want to set out the path that we will follow, and I want to try and answer all of the difficult questions that have been put to me. Let me try and make some progress, and I promise I'll take interventions as I go along. Let me set out what we know about what happened. Médecins Sans Frontières reported that in just 3 hours on the morning of the 21st of August, three hospitals in the Damascus area received approximately 3,600 patients with symptoms consistent with chemical weapons attacks. At least 350 of those innocent people died. The video footage illustrates some of the most sickening human suffering imaginable. An expert video analysis can find no way that this wide array of footage could have been fabricated, particularly the behaviour of small children in those shocking videos. There are pictures of bodies with symptoms consistent with that of nerve agent exposure, including muscle spasms and foaming at the nose and mouth. Mr. Speaker, anyone in this chamber who's not seen these videos, I believe, should force themselves to watch them. You can never forget the sight of children's bodies stored in ice, young men and women gasping for air and suffering the most agonising deaths, and all inflicted by weapons that have been outlawed for nearly a century. The Syrian regime has publicly admitted they were conducting a major military operation in the area at that time. The regime resisted calls for immediate and unrestricted access for UN inspectors, while artillery and rocket fire in the area reached a level around four times higher than the preceding 10 days. And there is intelligence that Syrian regime forces took precautions normally associated with chemical weapons use. Now, examining all this evidence, together with the available intelligence, the Joint Intelligence Committee has made its judgments. And it's done so in line with the reforms put in place after the Iraq War by Sir Robin Butler. We're today publishing these key judgments in a letter from the chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee. Now, the letter states, let me deal with this and I'll take some interventions. The letter states, there is little serious dispute that chemical attacks causing mass casualties on a larger scale than hitherto took place on the 21st of August. On the Syrian opposition, the letter states, there is no credible intelligence or other evidence to substantiate the claims or the possession of chemical weapons by the opposition. The Joint Intelligence Committee therefore concludes, it is not possible for the opposition to have carried out a chemical weapons attack on this scale. And it says this, and I quote, the regime has used chemical weapons on a smaller scale on at least 14 occasions in the past. There is some intelligence to suggest regime culpability in this attack, and these factors make it highly likely that the Syrian regime was responsible. And crucially, the JIC chairman, in his letter to me, makes this point absolutely clear. He says this, and I quote, there are no plausible alternative scenarios to regime responsibility. Now, I'm not standing here and saying there's some piece or some pieces of intelligence that I've seen or the JIC seen that the world won't see that convinces me that I'm right and anyone who disagrees with me is wrong. I am saying this is a judgment. We all have to reach a judgment about what happened and who was responsible. But I would put it to you that from all the evidence we have, the fact that opposition don't have chemical weapons, the fact the regime do, the fact they've used it, the fact they were attacking the area at the time, and that intelligence I've reported, that is enough to conclude that the regime is responsible and should be held accountable. Let me take the right honourable lady and then the honourable gentleman.
I'm grateful to the Prime Minister. What has convinced him, where is the evidence, that an action by the international community would cease the use of chemical weapons within Syria, a country where the combatants have accepted 100,000 dead, millions of refugees, and a continuing action which is destroying totally that country? Where is the evidence that convinces him that the external world can prevent this?
Yeah. Honourable lady makes an extremely serious point, and as I've just said, in the end, there is no 100% certainty about who is responsible. You have to make a judgment. There is also no 100% certainty about what path of action might succeed or fail. But let me say this to the Honourable Lady. I think we can be as certain as possible that when we have a regime that has used chemical weapons on 14 occasions, that is most likely responsible for this large-scale attack, that if nothing is done, it will conclude that it can use these weapons again and again and on a larger scale and with impunity. Talk about escalation. To me, the biggest danger of escalation is if the world community, not just Britain, but America and others, stand back and do nothing. Because I think Assad will draw very clear conclusions from that. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister is making a very powerful and heartfelt speech. Could he explain to the House why he thinks that President Assad did this? There seems to be no logic for this chemical attack, and that is what's worrying some people.
I think if he reads the... It's a very good question. If he reads the JIC conclusions, this is where they find the greatest difficulty of ascribing motives. Now, lots of motives have been ascribed. For my part, I think the most likely possibility is that he has been testing the boundaries. 14 uses and no response, at least 14 uses, and he wants to know whether the world will respond to the use of these weapons, which actually I suspect, tragically and repulsively, are proving quite effective on the battlefield. But in the end, we can't know the mind of this brutal dictator. All we can do is make a judgment about whether it is better to act or not to act, and whether to make a judgment about whether he's responsible or not responsible. In the end, these are all issues of judgment, and as members of Parliament, we will have to make them. I take a question from the Scottish National Party.
I'm very grateful to the Prime Minister. Does he know if there are any plans over the last few days for any military action before next week planned at all against Syria?
Well, I obviously can't discuss the details of potential action in detail in front of this House, but I can tell the House that the American President and I have had discussions that have been reported in the newspaper about potential military action. We have had those discussions, and the American President would like to have allies alongside the United States with the capability and with the partnership that Britain and America has. But we've set out very clearly what Britain would need to see to happen for us to take part in that. More action at the UN, a report by the UN inspectors, and a further vote in this House. Our actions won't be determined by my good friend and ally, the American President. They'll be decided by this government and votes in this House of Commons.
I agree with the Prime Minister about the horror of chemical weapons, but the vast majority of 100,000 killed so far in this civil war in Syria have been as a result of conventional weapons. Can he convince the House that military action by our country would shorten the civil war and help to herald in a post-war government that could create stability?
It's a good question. I can't make any of those assurances. Obviously, we have not made that decision. But were we to make a decision to join the Americans and others in military action, it would have to be action, in my view, that was solely about deterring and degrading the future use of chemical weapons by the Syrian regime. Full stop, end of story. And by the way, if we were aware of large-scale use of chemical weapons by the opposition, I'd be making the same argument from the same dispatch box and making the same recommendation. Let me take the Honourable Member for Harlow.
I'm grateful to my Honourable Friend for standing tall and for supporting Britain's traditions in our history where we have always stood against mass murder from dictators and tyrants. Does my Honourable Friend not agree that there is a humanitarian case for intervention, especially given what happened in recent history in Halabja in 1988, where 5,000 Kurds were killed with mustard gas?
Hear, hear.
Well, I applaud my Honourable Friend for always standing up against genocide wherever it takes place in the world. And it may well be that the fact that there was no action taken over Halabja was one of the things that convinced President Assad that it was okay to build up an arsenal of chemical weapons. Let me turn, I'm going to make some progress. As I said, the second part of my speech is to deal with the actions set out in our motion. I want to address those, and then I'll take some more interventions. Now, whatever disagreements there are over the complex situation in Syria, I believe there should be no disagreement that the use of chemical weapons is wrong. As I said, almost a century ago, the world came together to agree the 1925 treaty and to outlaw the use of chemical weapons. International law since that time has reflected a determination that the events of that war should never be repeated. It did put a line in the sand. It said that whatever happens, these weapons must not be used. Now, President Assad has, in my view, crossed that line, and there should now be consequences. This was the first significant use of chemical weapons this century, and taken together with the previous 14 small-scale attacks, it is the only instance of regular and indiscriminate use of chemical weapons by a state against its own people for at least 100 years. Interfering in another country's affairs should not be undertaken except in the most exceptional circumstances. It must be, as my Honourable Friend just said, a humanitarian catastrophe, and it must be a last resort. But by any standards, this is a humanitarian catastrophe, and if there are no consequences for it, there is nothing to stop Assad and other dictators from using these weapons again and again. As I've said, doing nothing is a choice. It's a choice with consequences, and these consequences, in my view, would not just be about President Assad and his future use of chemical weapons. Decades of painstaking work to construct an international system of rules and checks to prevent the use of chemical weapons and to destroy stockpiles will be undone. The global consensus against the use of chemical weapons will be fatally unravelled. A 100-year taboo will be breached. People ask about the British national interest. Is it not in the British national interest that rules about chemical weapons are upheld? In my view, of course it is, and that is why I believe we shouldn't stand idly by. Honourable gentlemen.
I'm grateful to the Prime Minister, and notwithstanding the differences I have with him on the issue of timing and his approach to conflict, can I bring up the issue of consequences? Does he agree with me that whoever is responsible for chemical weapons attacks should know that they will face a court, whether that is the International Criminal Court or a specially convened war crimes tribunal in the future. Because whether there is military intervention or not, somebody is responsible for a heinous crime. They should face the law.
Yeah. I certainly agree that people should be subject to the International Criminal Court, and of course possession and use of chemical weapons is a crime and can be prosecuted. But we have to recognise the slowness of those wheels and the fact that Syria is not even a signatory to that treaty. Let me make a little bit more progress and then I will give way. As I've said, I've consulted the Attorney General. He's confirmed the use of chemical weapons in Syria constitutes both a war crime and a crime against humanity. But I want to be very clear about the process that we follow, and the motion is clear about this. The weapons investigators in Damascus must complete their work. They should brief the United Nations Security Council. A genuine attempt should be made at a condemnatory Chapter 7 resolution backing all necessary measures. Then and only then could we have another vote of this House on British involvement in direct military action. Now, I explained again before the legal position, and I don't need to repeat that again, but I would urge colleagues to read this legal advice which I put in the Library of the House of Commons. But let me repeat one more time. We have not reached that point. We have not made the decision to act, but were there to be a decision to act, this advice proves that it would be legal. Now I'll take some interventions, starting with my honourable friend.
I'm very grateful for the Prime Minister giving way. Would he agree that our constituents across the House are concerned about Britain becoming involved in another Middle Eastern conflict, whereas what he is telling the House that he is focusing specifically on the war crimes use of chemical weapons, which is a very different matter from Britain being involved in a protracted Middle Eastern war?
I completely agree with my honourable friend. I'm fully aware of the deep public scepticism there is, the war weariness there is in our country, linked to the fact that people have had difficult economic times to deal with as well, and they're asking questions about why Britain has to do so much in the world. I totally understand that, and I think we should reassure our constituents by saying this is about chemical weapons. This is not about intervention. This is not about getting involved in another Middle Eastern war. I take the former Home Secretary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
I'm Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State.
Mr. Speaker, and Member of Parliament for Blackburn. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister said a moment ago in the hearing of the House that one of the purposes of any action would be the degrading, his words, of the chemical weapons capability of the Assad regime. In a letter which General Martin Dempsey, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sent to Carl Levin in the United States Congress a couple of months ago, he spelled out that fully to do that would involve hundreds of ships and aircraft and thousands of ground troops at a cost of $1 billion a month. Could the Prime Minister, since he's not proposing that, say what his objective would be in terms of degrading the chemical weapons capability?
I think, the Right Honourable Gentleman has had many jobs, Home Secretary, Foreign Secretary. Perhaps I should just refer to him as my constituent. That's probably a safer way of... but he makes a very good point. He makes a very good point, which is what I think the Dempsey letter was addressing, was that if you wanted entirely to dismantle or attempt to dismantle Syria's weapons arsenal, that would be an enormous undertaking that would involve ground troops, that would involve all sorts of things. That is not what is being proposed. What is being proposed, were we to take part, is an attempt to deter and to degrade the future use of. That is very different. And you would do that. I don't want to set out at the dispatch box of the House of Commons a list of targets, but it's perfectly simple and straightforward to think of actions you could take to do with command and control of the use of chemical weapons and the people and buildings involved in that, which would indeed deter and degrade. But honourable members will I think ask this point a number of different ways. How can we be certain any action will work? How can we be certain any action wouldn't have to be repeated? And frankly, these are judgment issues. The only really firm judgment I think we can all come to is that if nothing is done, we're more likely to see more chemical weapons used. I give way to my honourable friend.
grateful to the Prime Minister for giving way. Although the Joint Intelligence Committee say they're baffled as to the motivation for Assad using chemical weapons, they do say they have a limited but growing body of intelligence which supports the judgment that the regime was responsible. I appreciate that the Prime Minister cannot share such intelligence with the House as a whole, but members of the All-Party Intelligence and Security Committee have top secret clearance to look at precisely this sort of material. And as members of that committee, both some support and some oppose military intervention, would he be willing for members of the committee to see that material?
Well, I'm very happy to consider that request because the Intelligence and Security Committee plays a very important role. But let me say this. I don't want to raise, as perhaps was raised in the Iraq debate, the status of individual or even groups of pieces of intelligence into some sort of quasi-religious cult. That wouldn't be appropriate. What I've said to the House of Commons, there is an enormous amount of open source reporting. There is an enormous amount of videos we can see. There's the fact we know that the regime has an enormous arsenal. The fact they've used it before. The fact they were attacking that area. And then with the opposition, of course, there's the fact they don't have those weapons, they don't have those delivery systems, and the attack took place in an area which they were themselves holding. So yes, of course, intelligence is part of this picture. But let's not pretend there is one smoking piece of intelligence that can solve the whole problem. This is a judgment issue and one which honourable members will have to make a judgment. I give way to my honourable friend.
Thank the Prime Minister for giving way. He's been very... very generous. The reason many of us in Parliament opposed the arming of the rebels is not only that there was atrocities committed by both sides in this vicious civil war, but there was the real risk of escalating the violence and therefore the suffering. No matter how clinical the strikes, there is a real risk, I suggest, that the violence is escalated. It can only result in that. What assurances can he give, therefore, that this won't escalate the violence, both within the country and beyond Syria's borders?
Well, my honourable friend and I haven't agreed about every aspect of Syria policy, and that is well known. But the point I'd make is that if we were to take action, it would be purely and simply about degrading and deterring chemical weapons use. And when we worry about escalation, the greatest form of escalation that we have in front of us is the danger of additional chemical weapons use because nothing has been done. But as I say, this debate, this motion, this issue is not about arming the rebels. It's not about intervening in the conflict. It's not about invasion. It's not about changing our approach on Syria. It's about chemical weapons and something I think everyone in this House has an interest in. I give way to the Honourable Friend.
Thank you, Prime Minister, for giving way. The use of chemical weapons has made Syria our business. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that to miss the opportunity we have today to send a strong message to Assad and others that this House condemns this war crime, the use of chemical weapons, and we will stand by our obligations to deter them would be to undermine our own national security?
I think the Honourable Lady makes an important point. I think one of the questions our constituents ask most is where is the British national interest in all of this? Now, I would argue a stable Middle East is in the national interest, but I think there is a specific national interest relating to the chemical weapons use that we've seen and preventing its escalation. Now, I've tried in this section of my speech, I'll give way a bit more in a minute, I want to make some further progress and leave plenty of time for backbench speeches. I've been trying to address these questions that people have. Let me take the next question of whether we would be in danger of undermining our ambitions for a political solution in Syria. Now, there's not some choice between, on the one hand, acting to prevent chemical weapons being used against the Syrian people, and on the other, continuing to push for a long-term political solution. We need to do both. We remain absolutely committed to using diplomacy to end this war with a political solution. But let me make this point. For as long as Assad is able to defy international will and get away with chemical attacks on his people, I believe he will feel little, if any, pressure to come to the negotiating table. He is happy going on killing, maiming his own people as part of his strategy for winning that brutal civil war. So far from undermining the political process, a strong response over the use of chemical weapons, in my view, could actually strengthen that political process. I give way to the Chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee.
Can I thank the Prime Minister for giving way? One of the consequences of intervening will be the effect that it will have on other countries in the region. And my particular concern, as he knows, is Yemen, which is the most unstable country in the area. Has he looked at the consequences of what might happen with an intervention and the effects that it will have on the stability of a country like Yemen?
Well, of course, we have. I've taken advice from all of the experts about all of the potential impacts on the region. And this was actually the next question in my questions that need to be answered. The fact is the region has already been profoundly endangered by the conflict in Syria. You've got Lebanon facing sectarian tensions as refugees pile across the border. Jordan is coping with a massive influx of refugees. Our NATO ally, Turkey, has suffered terrorist attacks and shelling from across the border. But standing by as a new chemical weapons threat emerges in Syria is not going to alleviate those challenges. It's going to deepen them. And that's why the Arab League have been so clear in condemning the action, in attributing it precisely to President Assad, and in calling for international action. This is a major difference with past crises we've had in the Middle East, and a region long beset by conflict and aggression needs above all clear international laws and people and countries who are prepared to stand up for them. I give way to my honourable friend.
I'm grateful. I believe my constituents, like those of the rest of the House, want the Prime Minister to make clear on behalf of this country that we're not going to turn away from the illegal use of chemical weapons, but that we're going to give peace a chance. Will he assure us that he will continue to engage, however difficult, with Russia and the other key countries to try to make sure that the UN route is productive and that the diplomatic process is engaged again as soon as possible?
I absolutely agree with my right honourable friend that we must continue the process of diplomatic engagement. Even after I'd spoken to President Obama before the weekend, I called President Putin on Monday and had a long discussion with him about this issue. Now, we are a long way apart, but the one issue we do agree about is the need to get the Geneva II process going. So the assurance I can give him is that if there was any action, it would be immediately taken over by running a political process once again, and that Britain will do everything in its power to help make that happen. Let me answer a final question that has been put in the debate over recent days, and that is the question of whether this will risk radicalising more young Muslims, including people here in Britain. Now, this is a vital question, and it's one that wasn't asked enough in 2003. So this question was asked at the National Security Council yesterday, and we've received considered analysis from our counter-terrorism experts. Their assessment is that while as ever there is no room for complacency, the legal, proportionate and focused actions that would be proposed will not be a significant new cause of radicalisation and extremism. And I would make this point. Young Muslims in the region and here in Britain are looking at the pictures of Muslims suffering in Syria, seeing the most horrific deaths from chemical weapons. Many of them may be asking whether the world is going to step up and respond. And I believe the right message to give them is that we should. I'll take one more intervention from the honourable gentleman.
I'm very grateful to the Prime Minister. Would he reflect on the question from my right honourable friend from Leicester on the humanitarian situation, not just as it might appear in the future, but as it happens now, with thousands of refugees going to neighbouring countries? How can we be absolutely sure that, given that aid agencies like CAFOD have said that this is the worst situation of the 21st century, that we're not going to add in these neighbouring countries, including in North Africa, to the problems that we're facing?
The honourable gentleman makes an extremely important point. Right, honourable gentleman. And we should be proud in this House and in this country of the massive role aid agencies and British aid money is playing in relieving this disastrous humanitarian situation. We are one of the largest donors, and we'll go on making that investment because we're saving lives and helping people every day. But we have to ask ourselves the question, is the unfettered use of chemical weapons by this regime going to make the humanitarian situation worse? And I believe that it will. So if we believe there was a way of deterring and degrading future chemical weapons action, it would be irresponsible not to do it. And let me just make this point. When you study the legal advice published by the government, it makes the point that the intervention on the basis of humanitarian protection has to be about saving lives. So, Mr. Speaker, let me conclude where I began. The question before us is how to respond to one of the worst uses of chemical weapons in 100 years. The answer is that we must do the right thing and in the right way. We must be sure to learn the lessons of previous conflicts. We must pursue every avenue at the United Nations, every diplomatic channel, every
option for securing the greatest possible legitimacy for the steps that we take. And we must recognise the scepticism and concerns that many in the country will have after Iraq, explaining carefully and consistently all the ways in which this situation and the actions we take are so very different. We must ensure that any action, if it is to be taken, is proportionate, legal and specifically designed to deter the use of chemical weapons. We must ensure any action supports and is accompanied by a renewed effort to forge a political solution and relieve humanitarian suffering in Syria. But at the same time, we must not let the spectre of previous mistakes paralyse our ability to stand up for what is right. We must not be so afraid of doing anything that we end up doing nothing. Let me repeat again, there will be no action without a further vote in this House of Commons. But on this issue, Britain should not stand aside. We must play our part in a strong international response. We must be prepared to take decisive action in order to do so. That is what today's motion is about, and I commend it to the House.
Order. The question is the motion on Syria and the use of chemical weapons as published in corrected form. To move his amendment, I call the Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, I rise to move the amendment, standing in the name of myself and my right honourable friends. And I start by joining the Prime Minister in expressing revulsion at the killing of hundreds of innocent civilians in Ghouta on the 21st of August. There was a moral outrage. This was a moral outrage. And the international community is right to condemn it. As the Prime Minister said, everyone in this House, and most people in the country, will have seen the pictures of men, women and children gasping for breath and dying as a result of this heinous attack. I can assure members of this House that the divide that exists does not exist over the condemnation of the use of chemical weapons and the fact that it breaches international law. Nor does it lie in the willingness to condemn the regime of President Assad. The question facing this House is what, if any, military action we should take and what criteria should determine that decision. And that's what I want to focus on in my speech today. And I think it's right to say at the beginning of my remarks that the Prime Minister said a couple of times in his speech words to the effect of, "We're not going to get further involved in that conflict. This doesn't change our stance on Syria." Now, I've got to say to the Prime Minister, with the greatest respect, that that's simply not the case. For me, that does not rule out military intervention. I want to be clear about this. But I don't think anybody in this House or anybody in the country should be under any illusions about the effect of our relationship to the conflict in Syria if we were to militarily intervene. Now, as I say, and as I'll develop in my remarks, that does not, for me, rule out intervention. But I think we need to be clear-eyed. We need to be clear-eyed about the impact that this would have. Let me also say, Mr. Speaker, that this is one of the most solemn duties that this House possesses. And in our minds should be this simple question, which is upholding international law and legitimacy. How can we make the lives of the Syrian people better? And we should also have in our minds, it's right to remember it on this occasion, the duty we owe to the exceptional men and women of our armed forces and their families, who will face the direct consequences of any decision that we make. Now, Mr. Speaker, the basis on which we make this decision is of fundamental importance, because the basis of making the decision determines the legitimacy and moral authority of any action that we undertake. That's why our amendment asks the House to support a clear and legitimate roadmap to decision on this issue. A set of steps which enable us to judge any recommended international action. And I want to develop the argument about why this sequential roadmap is, I believe, the right thing for the House to support today. Most of all, if we follow this roadmap, it can assure the country and the international community that if we take action, we will have followed the right, legitimate and legal course, not an artificial timetable or a political timetable set elsewhere. And I think that is very, very important to any decision that we make. Mr. Speaker, this is fundamental to the principles of Britain. A belief in the rule of law, a belief that any military action we take must be justified in terms of the cause and also the potential consequences, and that we strain every sinew to make the international institutions that we have in our world work to deal with the outrages in Syria. Let me turn to the conditions in our motion. First, and this is where the Prime Minister and I now agree, we must let the UN weapons inspectors do their work and let them report to the Security Council. But Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary-General, said yesterday about the weapons inspectors, and I quote, "Let them conclude their work for 4 days, and then we will have to analyse scientifically with experts, and then we will have to report to the Security Council for action." So the weapons inspectors are in the midst of their work and will be reporting in the coming days. That is why today could not have been the day when the House was asked to decide on military action. For this House, it is surely a basic point. Evidence should precede decision, not decision precede evidence. And I am glad that on reflection the Prime Minister accepted this yesterday. Now it is true, because some people will raise this issue. The weapons inspectors cannot reach a judgment on the attribution of blame. That is beyond their mandate. Now, some might think that that makes their work essentially irrelevant. I disagree. If the UN weapons inspectors conclude that chemical weapons have been used, in the eyes of this country and the world, that confers legitimacy on the finding beyond the view of any individual country or any intelligence agency. What is more, it is possible that what the weapons inspectors discover could give the world greater confidence in identifying the perpetrators of this horrific attack. The second step, Mr. Speaker, in our roadmap makes clear there needs to be compelling evidence that the Syrian regime was responsible for the attacks. I welcome the letter from the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee today, and I note the Arab League's view of President Assad's culpability. Of course, as the Prime Minister said, in conflict there is always reason for doubt, but the greater the weight of evidence, the better. On Tuesday we were promised there will be the release of American intelligence that there was proof of the regime culpability. We await the publication of that evidence, which I'll be gathered will be later today, but that evidence too will be important in building up the body of evidence that President Assad was responsible. I will.
I'm very grateful to the Leader of the Opposition. He has said that he might be able to support military action of the kind that the government is contemplating. He has put in his amendment a list of requirements, virtually all of which, so far as I can tell, appear in the government's own motion. Why can he not, therefore, support the government's motion in order that this House could speak with a united voice to the world?
I'll develop in my remarks why I don't think that's the case. In particular, I would point to the fact that the government's amendment does not mention compelling evidence against President Assad. And I will develop in my remarks on the fifth point in our amendment, which is very, very important, the basis on which we judge whether action can be justified in terms of the consequences. And I will come to that later in my remarks. The third step, Mr. Speaker, is that in light of the weapons inspector's findings and this other evidence, and as the Secretary General said, the UN Security Council should then debate what action should be taken, and indeed should vote on action. Mr. Speaker, I've heard it suggested that we should have a United Nations moment. They're certainly not my words. They are words which do no justice to the seriousness with which we must take the United Nations. The UN is not some inconvenient sideshow, and we don't want to engineer a moment. Instead, we want to adhere to the principles of international law. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I very much welcome his doctrine that evidence should precede decision. That's a stark change from at least one of his predecessors. Can he tell the House whether he believes that the evidence which is being presented to us today by the Joint Intelligence Committee is compelling or not?
I think this is important evidence, but I think we need to gather further evidence over the coming days.
What you have been listening to is a very, very spirited discussion in the British Parliament yesterday that yielded a vote 285 to 272 saying that Britain should not join the United States and France in military strikes against Syria. Now, don't you feel a little bit odd that we have learned a heck of a lot more about what's at stake the issues that need to be discussed from British Parliament. They're discussing this in the open. The issues are there. They're wrangling with each other over them. And we hear nothing of the sort in the country that says it has the greatest democracy, the greatest sense of democracy in the in the world. That the United States is about transparency and people knowing what the government is thinking and doing. And here we are learning from the British Parliament, from the Prime Minister, and from the opposition leader, and you heard of all of the other parties that were included in asking questions of the Prime Minister. And as you can tell, he did not have an easy way to go. But he was able to present his point of view, and people were able to appreciate the arguments. And the opposition was able to come in behind all of that and reframe the issues at hand. This is what this president does not do. This is what our Congress does not do. And even as the country is on the brink of military action, they call it military action, let's call it what it is. It's an act of war. It's warfare. On the brink of warfare in Syria, and with the potential of all these ripple effects that you heard being raised, we still have, as a nation, we have no information at all, or very little, from the very nexus of power. The key decision makers are saying nothing to the people. This is an amazing thing. So I was intent on bringing that to you because I found it very fascinating and very, very instructive about this notion of democracy, about the right of people to know. And in this regard, President Obama is not an exception. This is the way it always has been. But President Obama is exceptional in the sense that he boasts and promises transparency. And here we are, literally, on the eve of warfare, and we have no information. I want to thank you. Our program has come to an end. I hope it served a purpose. And enjoy yourselves over this long weekend. We'll see each other on Tuesday, Monday being Labor Day. Thank you. Bye-bye.